Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing international best-selling English fantasy novelist Joe Abercrombie. Welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Very, very happy to be here.
Now, you're touring Australia promoting Red Country, your latest standalone in the world of your first trilogy. It's a fantasy, but in a Western mode. Now, Westerns are a genre all on its own. They do things a certain way, and I was wondering, what research did you do for the book, and was this the reason behind the Whiskey Death Match?
Well, the Whiskey Death Match was incidental. I would have aimed at a lot more bourbon if it had been, you know, specifically going towards the Western theme. As it is, I'm more of a... It's been more Scotch that I've been looking at, so those two were unrelated in a sense, except for the fact that obviously, you know, whiskey and any style of writing do go together well, in my opinion. But I suppose influences-wise, I grew up with Westerns on TV an awful lot. When you turned on the weekday matinee in my youth, it would tend to be a Western of one kind or another. And so I watched a whole range of stuff, you know, from John Ford classics through the Technicolor lantern jaws of films like Gunfight of the OK Corral, then right up to the spaghetti Westerns and the revisionist stuff of Clint Eastwood, you know, as well as a lot of written Westerns as well. So I had a lot of these influences kind of there long before ever taking up a pen. But specifically for this book, I read a lot of Western nonfiction, a lot of fiction about the American Civil War and the period directly before the settlement of the American West, the first scouts and kind of pioneers heading out across the plains. And then also a lot of biographies about some Western figures like Doc Holliday, like Wyatt Earp, these kind of people. Wild Bill Hickok, to get an idea of what their lives are really like, you know, away from the legends, if you will. And also read an awful lot of written Westerns, you know, Larry McMurtry, Cormac McCarthy, Elmore Leonard's Western stories. So I just tried to get as wide and varied a kind of snapshot of Western fiction and non-fiction as I could.
Okay, no, that's really interesting because I've not read a lot of Westerns, but I think in my own experience, yes, growing up rurally out here, we get the same sort of thing. Westerns on during odd times during the middle of the day, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of Deadwood.
Yeah, all them. Absolutely.
Until they cancelled it. But, I certainly... I finished the book yesterday.
Right.
And I felt, not being an aficionado of Western books, it felt like a Western to me. It still felt, I suppose, genuine is what I was trying to say. There's a possibility, I suppose, when you're researching another genre that it could tend towards pastiche. And I'm thinking, that it didn't feel that way for me. Was that a conscious sort of thing for you, that you were watching yourself going, now, I don't want this to be sort of disrespectful to the Western genre?
Yeah, I mean, I think a whole set of fine lines to walk, and with this book in particular, and I'm sure for some readers, you know, it'll fall on one side or the other. I mean, I've seen responses from people who feel it's much too self-consciously a Western, and from people who feel, you know, it's not Western enough, if you like. So there's a balance between, you know, it being a fantasy book that's set in this same world and incorporating those Western themes. I guess, you know, Western stuff is quite a strong spice within a book because, you know, if you're writing about war, we're used to seeing war stories in all kinds of different settings, all kinds of different eras. With Western things, if you're thinking of a cattle drive or a wagon train, or, you know, a standoff in a windswept street, these classic Western things, your mind automatically starts dressing it up with Stetsons and with chaps and with ammo belts with a couple of loops free and six shooters. It's very hard to kind of strike that balance between it being very overtly America in the 19th century and it being, you know, somewhere else being cooperating some Western ideas. So I think, yeah, I was always conscious of that and kind of concerned that it be neither a Western nor a fantasy book, but, you know, hopefully a melding of the two that feels to some degree original and not too tied to either one. And obviously whenever you write a book that incorporates a lot of, you know, a lot from a particular genre, I mean, equally with my trilogy, which obviously was very much epic fantasy, you do have to watch that line between, you know, being respectful, taking it seriously, telling a good story of the type, and, you know, saying something new without it becoming a parody. So you're always kind of conscious of those lines that you've got to walk to keep it believable, to keep it serious, to keep it kind of, you know, a good example of the form while at the same time saying something about the form.
Personally for me, I thought I didn't detect any sort of disrespect in the writing, so I fall on the fence, I suppose, in regards to that one. I thought it was good. I've only read the first book of the First Law trilogy, and comparing those two, I thought it was Joe Abercrombie's Western fantasy more so than Joe trying to do a Western fantasy, if you get what I mean. I think you succeeded in that regard.
Oh, so. Good, thanks. Yeah.
I'll move on to your tour around Australia at the moment. You recently appeared at the inaugural GenreCon, which is an Australian convention for writers of all genres, and I was just wondering how you found that experience and was wondering if there were similar sorts of conventions, particularly for genre writers in England.
Yeah, I found it a really interesting event, actually, and very professionally put together for a first time. It was interesting because it kind of combined lots of different genres. So there were romance writers there, there were thriller writers, there were, you know, writers of all kinds, sci-fi and fantasy as well, and a lot of publishers, a lot of editors. It was a very kind of professional event, if you like. I mean, there were a lot of unpublished and kind of aspiring writers there, but pretty much everyone there was a writer of one kind or another. So there was a lot of talk about, you know, the profession and the technicalities of publication, talk about, you know, the technicalities of writing, how people go about putting stories together. And so it's a very different type of convention from, say, the Supernova, which I've been at the following week, which is very much a fan thing. And in the UK, we tend to have, you know, a couple of very genre-specific events. So there's EasterCon, which is sci-fi mostly, but also fantasy. There's the British Fantasy Convention, which is mostly horror with a bit of fantasy. And so it was interesting to be at one that kind of was purely professionals, really, and also, you know, straddled the genres. It was interesting to kind of hear from romance writers, from thriller writers, from writers of all kinds about how they might approach certain facets of the craft, if you like.
I couldn't attend, but you know, I've been reading up on various reports from writers, and that seems to be the same sort of response, that it was a great professional or semi-professional convention. All right. Now, writers are a bit like sponges, soaking up their environment, the people, the places they visit. Later, of course, to be put to nefarious use in fiction. I was wondering if Australia's left an indelible mark on you and what grist for the mill you might have taken away from this visit.
Yeah, interesting question. I mean, often you don't kind of process that until a bit later. It's been quite a whirlwind trip. I've been, obviously, had a 24-hour flight out here. And then I was moving around Sydney quite a lot. I was in three different hotels in Sydney, three different parts of Sydney, and I was moving around the city a lot, visiting bookstores. And then I was in Hobart for a day. I was then in Brisbane for 3 or 4 days, but I was at Supernova for quite a lot of that time, obviously, you know, busy the whole time there. So I haven't really had a lot of time to process or, you know, just walk around and take anything in, but certainly it seems like a vibrant and exciting place, a lot of variety in the cities. Every city seems to have its own personality, its own character. So it's been really exciting, but I haven't had the chance to kind of get out and see much of the landscape, if you like. So it's been cities, and, you know, that I guess that's not necessarily, you know, useful as settings for me. The modern city is kind of something that I don't particularly cover. So it's been an exciting and interesting and a very useful trip. A lot of people to meet, a lot of readers to talk to. As far as research material, not quite so useful, I don't think.
Well, you'll have to come back at another time and have a bit of a holiday.
Yeah, get into the interior and see some landscape. I think that's what I'd need to do.
No worries. Okay, I was reading your blog. I do subscribe to your blog, but I was going back through some old posts and you were talking about maps in your work and whether they were strictly necessary. Now, personally, I can cope without a map. But similar to you, I think growing up, having read Tolkien, I was inspired to just sit down and draw, you know, countless maps of places that didn't exist.
Yeah.
I was wondering then what you thought about maps as art that enhances reader immersion in a secondary world.
Yeah, I mean, I think they can be really important. I suppose I always, you know, it was an either or thing with my first book. If my publisher had said, you know, we want a map, I would have been fine with that. I wouldn't have said no. No, I refuse to let you publish my book. but I could kind of see the sense in not having one, because I feel as though, you know, they've become very much a standard thing in epic fantasy, or they had done. And to me, they were part of a focus on setting over character that I wanted to steer away from a little bit. I wanted to be very tightly focused on characters. I had this feeling that epic fantasy was often told in big wide shots, to use a filmic metaphor. You know, you'd see the huge world and the big mountains, but the characters would be these tiny figures sort of lost in there, these cardboard cutouts without a lot of vivid personality. And I wanted everything to be in really tight close-up, to really feel like you were pressed up uncomfortably close to the characters, with the setting as a kind of vague background. And so a map felt like, you know, the widest shot you can have, in a sense. And it felt like giving a lot of information to people that the characters wouldn't necessarily have. So it was kind of separating the reader from the experience of the characters in some way, it felt. So I could see the sense in not doing it. And then with subsequent books, it felt as though they were in more focused areas. I mean, the heroes in particular is kind of invented military history in a way within a fantasy world. So it made sense then to have much more focused map that showed the kind of the area in which the battle the book centered around takes place, and then to have kind of additional maps that show the positions of units and so on. And so gives the sense of it being a military history, a real event. And so, yeah, talking about reader immersion, I think that kind of thing is very useful. And if the map is, you know, very well done, is artistically done, is kind of done in a way that feels of a piece with the work and creates, you know, that kind of sense of place that good artwork will do, I think it's a real advantage and a plus in a book. But it's got to be right. I think it's got to be right rather than just, you know, knee-jerk choice because people feel like this sort of book should have a map in it. So I think always use them where they are appropriate and where there's a good use for them, but otherwise not.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking there for a second about a different genre, and somebody else had included a map in the front of their book, and this was a thriller genre, and they'd done sort of a simple, I suppose, almost like a MS Paint program, and it just didn't. It actually worked to jar me out of the book a bit, and I thought, oh, okay, couldn't they have done some, you know, fancy schematics or something that fitted with the science fiction notion of the book.
Yeah.
But you mentioned their film and sort of coming in close. You're a freelance film editor.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, what of the creative skill set that you have for that work did bleed into your writing, if any, in the sense that you might approach things from a cinematic or film angle?
Yeah, I mean, I was an editor of mostly documentary and live music for about 10 years freelance, and I think one very important thing was that job gave me time off. You know, I was always, even if I was busy and had a lot of work on, there'd be a week or two in between each job where I'd be off, in effect. And so having that time was one of the major kind of reasons I started writing. So that was certainly important. I think also when you're an editor, you're one kind of cog in the big machine, and you might cut your wonderful, beautiful sequence, and then a director arrives and says, no, we're actually going to ditch that sequence, or we're going to cut it down to 30 seconds, or we've got to change it all around to fit the voiceover. And so, you know, no editor likes doing that, but usually you have to learn to see the bigger picture, to take on comments and kind of learn to see comments and commands, indeed, as a opportunity to look at things again with fresh eyes and improve them from your point of view and from theirs. So I think it was a very useful experience in working with an editor myself, because I really enjoy actually working with an editor and taking in other opinions and seeing that as a jumping off point to pull things apart and try them a different way. And then I think also, you learn a lot of lessons about pacing as an editor. If you're trying to cut an hour-long show and you know where the ad breaks have got to be and you've got to conform to quite a strict structure, especially with a documentary where there isn't always a structure there before you start. You've got to impose a storyline and find a central point and find a theme, find, you know, narrative thrust within a lot of disparate mess of material often.
Mm.
So I think it's a very useful skill in kind of organising yourself, in organising your work, in thinking about where to come in and out of a sequence, in giving a story kind of beats and rhythm and flow. So I think those skills in a way are to some degree transferable between writing and visual media.
Well, we're talking a bit about film. Mm. Has the thought of putting one of your books or the trilogy into film occurred to you? And if, you know, money was no option, and they're throwing money at you, for say, who would you like to see direct it? And if you could pick one actor for your favourite character, who would that be?
Well, I think the question, asking the writer the question, have you thought about having your books on film, is a bit like asking someone, have you thought about winning the lottery? You know, yeah, you've thought about it, but you can't necessarily make it happen. You're obviously waiting for someone to kind of come to you who wants to take it on. And I mean, usually that'll take the form of someone who'll option it, you know, pay you a small amount of money to have the chance to take it away themselves and develop it, and until it reaches a point where they have producers attached to it, script writers, they have a script and so on, and can actually get the investment and the budget from someone to start making it, at which point you then actually sell the rights. So it's usually a very, very long, drawn-out and complicated process, and you don't want to get too involved in it, in a sense, as a writer, because I think, you know, it's very hard to control it. You can put a lot of work into something that produces nothing. And so you're kind of waiting for filmmakers to come forward and want to be involved with it in a way. And I think what I'd want to do is really, you know, give it away to a filmmaker who'd do justice to it. And so it kind of relies on someone coming forward. I don't have a strong feeling about who would want to do it, who I'd want to do it, because it has to be, you know, someone who would want to do it. I don't tend to think that much in terms of kind of casting it and what actors would be used and those kind of things. I sort of, I often prefer to see what other people do with it. I'm always interested when artists kind of produce, you know, impressions of the characters and so on, because even if they're not the way you see them, in a way it's more interesting to see how they see them. So I suppose I'm waiting for the right treatment and the right interest, really, film-wise.
I had pictures in my mind when I was reading Red Country of some of the cast members from Deadwood. The register came to mind. I had Calamity Jane as Shy, although less drunk Calamity Jane. there were certain other people too. I thought there were. I could hear Al Swearengen in a couple of characters.
Deadwood was fantastic. I mean, I really enjoyed that and thought it was a very bold and impressive kind of piece of work with some amazing script and acting going on. I was a big fan of that.
Yeah, no, and I think your dialogue in the book, in both of them that I've read, but certainly in Red Country, was it just hit that same note for me, where it's sort of darkly humorous.
Oh yeah, and high praise indeed.
No, I don't often laugh when I'm reading books, but there were just some classic setups in, you know, where they're going backwards and forwards, and it's beautiful writing. I thought so. Well done.
Not that you need my
praise, but it was good. It was a nice thing to have, to be able to sort of smirk and giggle along with the book. So.
Yeah, well, I think it's very important that there be some kind of some wit in there. You know, again, that thing of striking a balance between, you know, parody and seriousness. You know, I think epic fantasy has often been quite slow, quite solemn, you know, and alternatively quite, you know, full-on satire, full-on parody. So I like to try and tread a middle ground if I can, where, you know, it's not a joke, overall, but it has some humour in it, and the characters have some sense of humour and some wit, you know, because I like to read that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think also because the content is dark in places, and it can, you know, there's some fairly vicious sort of violence that occurs. I think that even realistically, that the way we deal with violence is to try and have a bit of a joke about it, to distance ourselves, I suppose. And that comes through with the characters as something that they would do anyway, I think.
Right, yeah.
So I didn't find that was... felt forced in there, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I was listening to another podcast, Jonathan Strahan and Gary K. Wolfe do the Cood Street podcast.
Okay.
And they were looking at talking about science fiction and fantasy, and I'm probably paraphrasing them a bit too much, taking a bit of content out of what they were saying, but they were indicating that science fiction was a bit more forward-looking, whereas fantasy was a bit more pining for past glories, simpler times, moral certitude, that sort of thing.
Mm.
I found your work to have sort of modern, gritty, cynical edge to it, and I was wondering what you thought to the idea of fantasy being backwards looking. What do you think that your work could say about current times, I suppose, is what I'm getting at there.
I mean, I think fantasy has at times been very backward looking and quite, you know, conservative with a small c, quite romanticising of the past, and you often get these medieval worlds that seem to have no change in them, that seem locked in time, and often the heroes are kind of concerned with the preservation of the past rather than moving forward, and you know, forces for progress are seen as evil and threatening and dangerous. And I guess I wanted certainly to move away from that. I think there's a definite tendency in recent fantasy towards things that are much more modern in outlook, that are much more morally ambiguous, that are much more kind of realistic in their depiction of a changing world and a shifting society, you know, and some of the problems and the conflicts arising from sort of technological and social development. That was the kind of world I wanted to portray. And I think, you know, closely allied to that is that fantasy has often, you know, been written in quite archaic language. I think, you know, a lot of people have imitated Tolkien, and he was very, very good at what he did, but some of the imitators aren't perhaps quite as good. And you end up with a sort of faux medievalism often, which isn't very convincing or believable, isn't very truthful, if you like. And my attitude's always been, you know, I read a lot of writers like James Ellroy, like Dashiell Hammett, and writers who use a modern idiom and a tough, sharp, stripped-down kind of prose style. And I always felt like I wanted to apply that to fantasy. I find that, you know, even if we're writing in a supposedly medieval or Renaissance or you know, early modern milieu, you can't pretend you're not writing for a modern reader and that you're a modern writer for that matter. So the truthful thing I've often thought is to kind of write in a modern, uncompromising way. So that's what I try and do. And I think I think science fiction actually can often be quite conservative and you know, it doesn't necessarily face the challenges of the future. Any good book, I think, tackles the now, tackles us and who we are. And it may well be the case that, you know, in recent years we've become a lot more cynical. We've become more cynical about power, about morality. You know, people see the world not so much in terms of good and evil as, you know, different standpoints, different viewpoints. And I think, you know, you've got to face the fact that that's generally how the world is. So, yeah, I think a lot of recent fantasy, gritty fantasy, I suppose you might call it, tries to look at that and reflect it. So I would disagree. I mean, I think traditionally fantasy can be quite conservative, but... I mean, the other thing is that science fiction is not... I feel as though science fiction is becoming kind of less and less relevant in a way. I think commercially it's getting less relevant, and there are fewer people generally reading it. I think there are fewer people writing it. It feels as though there's less to look for in the future, in a way, than there was at one time. We're living in a very futuristic era. And so, yeah, I kind of feel if this is a battle between fantasy and science fiction. It's not a battle, but if it were, I think I'd be on the side of fantasy. That's where the smart money is.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just thinking Jonathan and Gary are probably saying, I didn't say that, Sean.
No, they probably are. But, you know, I like to knock down straw men, you know. They don't fight back. They just lie there dead. It's good stuff.
I listen to them, and they're more of a science fiction podcast. But, yeah, so Jonathan and Gary, if they're listening, I'm not saying that's exactly what you said, but that's where I'm pulling my memories from. So, I think there's in terms of commercially, I think you're probably right there in terms of what's going to be bought and read. This seems to be you go to science fiction and fantasy events, and apart from the big movies like the franchises, like the superhero stuff that's coming out now. You know, fantasy is the big kid on the block. So, yeah, I'd probably edge towards fantasy in terms of commercial sense. Although, like you, I probably enjoy both. So it's not.
I think filmically, sci-fi is still very popular, but within the book world, it feels like it's due for a big renewal, a big injection of new ideas, a kind of big movement that's going to take it in a new direction.
Yeah. We certainly hope so. Anyway, coming towards the end of the interview now, I just wanted to ask you. You've done an unconventional fantasy trilogy with First Law series. You've done a bit of a hard-boiled thriller, and then with Heroes, you've done a bit of a critique of war. War as being futile, I suppose. You're showing us how versatile fantasy can be, I guess, and I was just wondering what you're encouraged to do next.
Well, I mean, all I've got left now is the zombie romance, really. So, you know, it's going to have to be that. The zombie romance, decology, ten books, zombies, romance, an epic sweep of love against the background of undeath. I think that's got to be the way to go. I'm going to do a trilogy next, which because I signed a deal and then I spent the money, so I've got to do that. It will probably be similar in tone to the first book, so less self-consciously kind of looking to another genre for inspiration, if you like. Less self-consciously stealing ideas from other people. It'll be more in the mould of classic fantasy, though, again, you know, with its own twists, I'm sure. So that's the next thing on the agenda within this world. And there'll probably be a couple of other minor projects. I've got a couple of short stories coming out that I've written and are sort of waiting for the publication queue to push them through. And, yeah, I mean, longer term than that, I'm not sure. I don't tend to really think about that far ahead. I'm not someone who has a kind of suitcase full of half-developed ideas. In the attic, and when they finish a book, it's like, oh, what have I got on the back burner? I tend to kind of, you know, develop an idea, you know, think of an idea not long before I need it, develop it and kind of work it out and flesh it out and plan it. And it's usually quite a lot of time spent, you know, sitting and chipping away at it generally. So, yeah, I mean, trilogy next, and beyond that, who can say? I'd quite like to have a go at kind of something more explicitly noir. So, you know, almost a private investigator, Maltese Falcon-style plot line within a fantasy setting. I mean, that's certainly a single one I think I could do. But, yeah, beyond that, I haven't really thought hugely far ahead, which is a problem. I mean, I think, clearly, if you're going to have a career, I had this horrifying realisation early on as I was finishing my trilogy, which I never thought I'd do, of course. I had this horrifying realisation I might have another 30 books in me, 40 books in me, and in a career. And so, you know, you're going to have to... You don't want to do the same thing over and over and over, either for your reader's sake or for yours. You want to be doing something different, at least, with each book. And so, yeah, I suppose I'll have to cover some ground at some point, but I'm not sure what that ground will be yet.
When you talk about 30 or 40 books, that doesn't sound as good as it might do.
No.
when you've got to come up with the ideas.
You see them stretching out ahead of you in pitiless abundance, that's for sure.
No. Well, I'd like to say it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, Joe, even at this early hour. We're about a half an hour behind you over here in South Australia. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
And So thank you for agreeing to the interview, and I'd like to say, have a great time on your tour. I'm going to try and get down to Adelaide to say hello when you come in over the weekend for Supernova. But if I don't get the chance, well, thank you very much.
No, pleasure. Absolute pleasure.